copyist to have it copied, which will immediately put me 1,000 or 1,200 francs in debt. Once the parts exist, I shall be plagued by the temptation to have the work performed. I shall give a concert, the receipts of which will barely cover one half of the costs. That is inevitable these days. I shall lose what I haven't got, and be short of money to provide for the poor invalid, and no longer able to meet my personal expenses or pay my son's board on the ship he will shortly be joining. These thoughts made me shudder, and I threw down my pen thinking, what of it? I shall have forgotten it by tomorrow. That night, the symphony again appeared and obstinately resounded in my head. I heard the Allegro in A minor quite distinctly. More, I seemed to see it written. I woke in a state of feverish excitement. I sang the theme to myself. Its form and character pleased me exceedingly. I was on the point of getting up. Then my previous thoughts recurred and held me fast. I lay still, steeling myself against temptation, clinging to the hope I would forget. At last I fell asleep, and when I next awoke, all recollection of it had vanished forever. Chapter 24. Seduction and Indifference. There is a tendency in philosophy to separate the mind, the intellectual operations, from the passions, the emotions. This tendency moves into psychology, and thence into neuroscience. The neuroscience of music in particular has concentrated almost exclusively on the neural mechanisms by which we perceive pitch, tonal intervals, melody, rhythm, and so on, and until very recently has paid little attention to the affective aspects of appreciating music. Yet music calls to both parts of our nature. It is essentially emotional, as it is essentially intellectual. Often when we listen to music, we are conscious of both. We may be moved to the depths, even as we appreciate the formal structure of a composition. We may, of course, lean to one side or the other, depending on the music, our mood, our circumstances. Dido's lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas is heartbreaking, tender emotion incarnate. The art of fugue, on the other hand, demands extreme intellectual attention. Its beauty is of a sterner, perhaps more impersonal kind. Professional musicians, or anyone practicing a piece of music, may sometimes have to listen with a detached, critical ear to ensure that all the minutiae of a performance are technically correct. But technical correctness alone is not enough. Once this is achieved, emotion must return, or one may be left with nothing beyond an arid virtuosity. It is always a balance, a coming together, that is needed. That we have separate and distinct mechanisms for appreciating the structural and the emotional aspects of music is brought home by the wide variety of responses and even dissociations that people have to music. There are many of us who lack some of the perceptual or cognitive abilities to appreciate music, but nonetheless enjoy it hugely and enthusiastically bawl out tunes, sometimes shockingly off-key, in a way that gives us great happiness, though it may make others squirm. There are others with an opposite balance. They may have a good ear, be finely sensitive to the formal nuances of music, but nevertheless do not care for it greatly, or consider it a significant part of their lives. That one may be quite musical, and yet almost indifferent to music, or almost tone-deaf, yet passionately sensitive to music, is quite striking. While musicality, in the sense of one's perceptual abilities, is probably hardwired to a considerable extent, emotional susceptibility to music is more complex, for it may be powerfully influenced by personal factors as well as neurological ones. When one is depressed, music may go dead on one, but this is usually part of an overall flattening or withdrawal of emotion. What is clear and dramatic, though fortunately rare, is the sudden and isolated loss of the ability to respond to music emotionally, while responding normally to everything else, including the formal structure of music. Such a temporary extinction of emotional response to music can occur after a concussion. Lawrence R. Friedman, a physician, told me of how he was confused and disoriented for 6 days following a bicycle accident, and then experienced a specific indifference to music. In a subsequent article about this, he observed, "There was one thing I noticed in the early days at home that disturbed me greatly. I was no longer interested in listening to music. I heard the music. I knew it was music, and I also knew how much I used to enjoy listening to music. It had always been the primary unfailing source that nourished my spirit. Now it just didn't mean anything. I was indifferent to it. I knew something was very wrong." This loss of emotional reaction to music was very specific. Dr. Friedman noted that he felt no diminution of his passion for visual art after his concussion. He added that since writing about his experience, he had spoken to 2 other people, both musicians, who had had the same experience after a head injury. "Those who experience this peculiar indifference to music are not in a state of depression or fatigue. They do not have a generalized anhedonia. They respond normally to everything except music, and their musical sensibility usually returns in days or weeks. It is difficult to know exactly what is being affected in such post-concussion syndromes, for there may be widespread, if temporary, changes in brain function, affecting many different parts of the brain. There have been a number of anecdotal reports of people who, following strokes, have lost interest in music, finding it emotionally flat, while apparently retaining all of their musical perceptions and skills. It has been suggested that such losses or distortions of musical emotion are more common with damage to the right hemisphere of the brain. Occasionally, there is not so much a complete loss of musical emotion as a change in its valence or direction, so that music which previously delighted one may now arouse an unpleasant feeling, sometimes so intense as to produce anger, disgust, or simply aversion. One correspondent, Maria Ralescu, described this to me in a letter. "My mother recovered from a 6-day coma after a head injury to the right side of the brain, and started the process of relearning with enthusiasm. When she was moved from the ICU to a hospital room, I brought her a small radio, because she had always listened to music with a passion. But after the accident, while in hospital, she adamantly refused to have any kind of music on. It seemed to annoy her. It took a couple of months for her to finally appreciate and enjoy music again." There have been very few detailed studies of such patients, but Timothy Griffiths, Jason Warren et al., have described how one man, a 52-year-old radio announcer who suffered a dominant hemisphere stroke with a transient aphasia and hemiplegia, was left with a persistent alteration in auditory experience. He was in the habit of listening to classical music, and had derived particular pleasure from listening to Rachmaninoff preludes. He experienced an intense, altered state of transformation when he did this. This emotional response to the music was lost following the stroke, and remained absent during the period of testing between 12 and 18 months after the stroke. During this period, he was able to enjoy other aspects of life and reported no biological features of depression. He had noticed no change in his hearing and was still able to identify speech, music, and environmental sounds correctly. Isabel Peretz and her colleagues have been especially concerned with amusia, the loss or congenital lack of ability to make structural judgments about music. They were astounded to find in the early 1990s that some of their subjects, rendered virtually amusic by brain injuries, were nonetheless still able to enjoy music and to make emotional judgments about it. One such patient, listening to Albinoni's Adagio from her own record collection, first said that she had never heard the piece before, then commented that it makes me feel sad and the feeling makes me think of Albinoni's Adagio. Another patient of Peretz's was I.R., a 40-year-old woman who had mirror aneurysms of both middle cerebral arteries. When these were clipped, the surgery caused extensive infarctions in both temporal lobes. After this, she lost the ability to recognize previously familiar melodies, and even to discriminate musical sequences. Despite these gross deficits, Peretz and Gagnon wrote in 1999, I.R. claimed that she could still enjoy music. Detailed testing supported her claim. These and other cases led Peretz to think that there must be a particular functional architecture underlying the emotional interpretation of music, an architecture which could be spared even if amusia was present. The details of this functional architecture are being slowly worked out, partly through the study of patients who have had strokes, brain injuries, or surgical removal of parts of the temporal lobes, and partly through functional brain imaging of subjects as they experience intense emotional arousal while listening to music. This has been a focus of work by Robert Zatori and his lab. See, for example, Blood and Zatori's 2001 paper. Both lines of research have implicated a very extensive network involving both cortical and subcortical regions as the basis for emotional responses to music. And the fact that one may have not only a selective loss of musical emotion, but an equally selective sudden musicophilia, as described in chapters 1 and 27, implies that the emotional response to music may have a very specific physiological basis of its own, one which is distinct from that of emotional responsiveness in general. Indifference to music's emotional power may occur in people with Asperger's syndrome. Temple Grandin, the brilliant autistic scientist I described in An Anthropologist on Mars, is fascinated by musical form and is particularly attracted to music by Bach. She told me once that she had been to a concert of Bach's 2- and 3-part inventions. I asked if she had enjoyed them. They were very ingenious, she replied, adding that she wondered whether Bach would have been up to 4- or 5-part inventions. But did you enjoy them? I asked again, and she gave me the same answer, saying that she got intellectual pleasure from Bach, but nothing more. Music, she said, did not move her to the depths, as it apparently could, she had observed, with other people. There is some evidence, indeed, that those medial parts of the brain involved with experiencing deep emotions, the amygdala in particular, may be poorly developed in people with Asperger's. It was not only music that failed to move Temple deeply. She seemed to experience a certain flattening of emotion generally. Once, when we were driving together in the mountains and I remarked on them with awe and wonder, Temple said she did not know what I meant. The mountains are pretty, she said, but they don't give me a special feeling. And yet, though Temple seemed indifferent to music, this is not true of all people with autism. Indeed, I formed an opposite impression during the 1970s, when I worked with a group of young people with severe autism. It was only through music that I could establish any contact with the most inaccessible among them, and I felt this so strongly that I brought my own piano, an old second-hand upright at the time, into the hospital ward where I worked. It seemed to act as a sort of magnet for some of these non-verbal youngsters. We move on to more uncertain ground with regard to certain historical figures who have been, by their own and others' description, indifferent, or sometimes averse, to music. It is possible that they were profoundly amusic. We have no evidence to either support or refute this possibility. It is difficult, for example, to know what to make of the peculiar omission of any reference to music in the work of the James brothers. There is only a single sentence devoted to music in the 1,400 pages of William James's Principles of Psychology, which treats virtually every other aspect of human perception and thought, and looking through biographies of him, I can find no reference to music. Ned Roram, in his diary, Facing the Night, observes the same striking absence in Henry James, that in none of his novels, and in none of the biographies, is there any mention of music. Perhaps the brothers grew up in a musicless household. Could lack of exposure to music in one's earliest years cause a sort of emotional amusia, as lack of language in the critical period may undermine linguistic competence for the rest of one's life? A different and rather sad phenomenon, a loss of feeling for music and much else, is expressed by Darwin in his autobiography. In one respect, My mind had changed during the last 20 or 30 years. Formerly, pictures gave me considerable and music very intense delight. But now I have almost lost my taste for pictures or music. My mind seems to have become a sort of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of fact. The loss of these tastes, this curious and lamentable loss of the higher aesthetic tastes, is a loss of happiness, and may possibly be injurious to the intellect, and more probably to the moral character, by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature. And we are on much more complex ground when it comes to Freud, who, as far as one can judge from accounts, never listened to music voluntarily or for pleasure, and never wrote about music, though he lived in intensely musical Vienna. He would rarely and reluctantly let himself be dragged to an opera, and then only a Mozart one, and when he did, would use such occasions to think about his patients or his theories. Freud's nephew Harry, in a not entirely reliable memoir, My Uncle Sigmund, wrote that Freud despised music, and that the whole Freud family was very unmusical, but neither of these assertions seems to be true. A much more delicate and nuanced comment was made by Freud himself, on the only occasion on which he wrote about the subject, in the introduction of The Moses of Michelangelo. "I am no connoisseur in art. Nevertheless, works of art do exercise a powerful effect on me, especially those of literature and sculpture, less often of painting. I spend a long time before them, trying to apprehend them in my own way, i.e., to explain to myself what their effect is due to. Wherever I cannot do this, as for instance with music, I am almost incapable of obtaining any pleasure. Some rationalistic, or perhaps analytic turn of mind in me, rebels against being moved by a thing without knowing why I am thus affected, and what it is that affects me." I find this comment at once puzzling and rather poignant. One wishes that Freud might have been able, on occasion, to abandon himself to something as mysterious, as delightful, and, one would think, as unthreatening as music. Did he enjoy and respond to music as a boy, when he was not committed to explaining and theorizing? We know only that he was denied the pleasure of music as an adult. Perhaps indifference is not quite the word here, and the Freudian term resistance would be nearer the mark, resistance to the seductive and enigmatic power of music. And it may be that a similar resistance underlay Nabokov's disdainful comment that music affected him merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. For many of us, the emotions induced by music may be overwhelming. A number of my friends who are intensely sensitive to music cannot have it on as background when they work. They must attend to music completely or turn it off, for it is too powerful to allow them to focus on other mental activities. States of ecstasy and rapture may lie in wait for us if we give ourselves totally to music. A common scene during the 1950s was to see entire audiences swooning in response to Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley, seized by an emotional and perhaps erotic excitement so intense as to induce fainting. Wagner, too, was a master of the musical manipulation of emotions, and this, perhaps, is a reason why his music is so intoxicating to some and so hateful to others. Tolstoy was deeply ambivalent about music, because it had, he felt, a power to induce in him fictitious states of mind, emotions and images that were not his own and not under his control. He adored Tchaikovsky's music, but often refused to listen to it, and in the Kreutzer Sonata he described the seduction of the narrator's wife by a violinist and his music. The two of them play Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata together, and this music is so powerful, the narrator comes to think, that it can change a woman's heart and cause her to be unfaithful. The story ends with the outraged husband murdering his wife, though the real enemy, he feels, the enemy he cannot kill, is the music. Chapter 25. Lamentations, Music and Depression. Robert Burton, in The Anatomy of Melancholy, wrote at length of music's power, and John Stuart Mill found that when he fell into a state of melancholia or anhedonia as a young man, music and nothing else had the power to pierce through this, to give him, at least for a while, a feeling of pleasure and being alive. Mill's depression, it is thought, stemmed from the ruthless regime imposed by his father, who demanded incessant intellectual work and achievement from the time John Stuart was 3, while doing little to nurture or even recognize his son's emotional needs. Not surprisingly, the young prodigy had a crisis when he reached adulthood and entered a state in which nothing could give him any pleasure except music. Mill was not choosy about the music. He wanted cheerful, lively melodies, and Mozart, Haydn, and Rossini were equally to his taste. His only fear was that he might exhaust the musical repertoire and have nothing left to turn to. The continuing and general need for music which Mill described is distinct from the crucial effect that particular pieces of music may have at particular times. William Styron, in his memoir Darkness Visible, described such an experience when he was very close to suicide. My wife had gone to bed, and I had forced myself to watch the tape of a movie. At one point in the film, which was set in late 19th century Boston, the characters moved down the hallway of a music conservatory, beyond the walls of which, from unseen musicians, came a contralto voice, a sudden soaring passage from the Brahms Alto Rhapsody. This sound, which like all music, indeed like all pleasure, I had been numbly unresponsive to for months, pierced my heart like a dagger, and in a flood of swift recollection, I thought of all the joys the house had known, the children who had rushed through its rooms, the festivals, the love, and work. I have had a few similar experiences myself, in which music has pierced my heart, in Styron's words, when nothing else could, especially, perhaps, in bereavement. I was passionately fond of my mother's sister, my Auntie Len. I often felt she had saved my sanity, if not my life, when I was sent away from home as a child, evacuated from London during the war. Her death left a sudden huge hole in my life, but for some reason I had difficulty mourning. I went about my work, my daily life, functioning in a mechanical way, but inside I was in a state of anhedonia, numbly unresponsive to all pleasure, and equally sadness. One evening I went to a concert, hoping against hope that the music might revive me, but it did not work. The whole concert bored me, until the last piece was played. It was a piece I had never heard before, by a composer I had never heard of, The Lamentations of Jeremiah by Jan Dismus Zelenka, an obscure Czech contemporary of Bach's, I later learned. Suddenly, as I listened, I found my eyes wet with tears. My emotions, frozen for weeks, were flowing once again. Zelenka's lamentations had broken the dam, letting feeling flow where it had been obstructed, immobilized inside me. A similar reaction to music was described by Wendy Lesser in her book Room for Doubt. She, too, lost a Lenny, in her case a beloved friend rather than a beloved aunt. Where, for me, the releaser of emotion, the cathartic, was Zelenka's lamentations, for Lesser it was Brahms's Requiem. That performance of the Brahms Requiem had a powerful effect on me. I went to Berlin thinking I would write about David Hume there, but as the waves of music poured over me, listening with my whole body, it seemed, and not just my ears, I realized I was going to have to write about Lenny instead. I had been carrying Lenny's death in a locked package up till then, a locked, frozen package that I couldn't get at, but couldn't throw away either. It wasn't just Lenny that had been frozen. I had, too. But as I sat in the Berlin Philharmonic Hall and listened to the choral voices singing their incomprehensible words, something warmed and softened in me. I became, for the first time in months, able to feel again. When I got the news of my mother's death, I flew at once to London, to the parental house, where, for a week, we sat shiver for her. My father, my three brothers and I, along with my mother's surviving brothers and sisters, all sat on low chairs, nourished emotionally and physically by the continual succession of relatives and friends who brought food and memories. Very movingly, many of my mother's patients and students came to pay their respects. Everywhere there was warmth, care, love, support, a flowing and sharing of feelings. But when I returned after this week to my empty and frigid apartment in New York, my feelings froze, and I fell into what is inadequately called a depression. For weeks I would get up, dress, drive to work, see my patients, try to present a normal appearance. But inside I was dead, as lifeless as a zombie. Then one day as I was walking down Bronx Park East, I felt a sudden lightening, a quickening of mood, a sudden whisper or intimation of life, of joy. Only then did I realize that I was hearing music, though so faintly it might have been no more than an image or a memory. As I continued to walk, the music grew louder, until finally I came to its source, a radio pouring Schubert out of an open basement window. The music pierced me, releasing a cascade of images and feelings, memories of childhood, of summer holidays together, and of my mother's fondness for Schubert. She would often sing his Nachtgesang in a slightly off-key voice. I found myself not only smiling for the first time in weeks, but laughing aloud and alive once again. I wanted to linger by the basement window. Schubert, and only Schubert, I felt, was life. Only his music had the secret of keeping me alive. But I had a train to catch, and kept walking, and I fell into my depression again. A few days later, by chance, I heard that the great baritone, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, would be performing Schubert's Windreise at Carnegie Hall. The performance was sold out, but I joined a crowd of people outside hoping to get in, and managed to buy a ticket for $100. This was a huge amount in 1973, and my earnings then were modest, but it seemed a small price to pay, as I put it to myself, for my life. But when Fischer-Dieskau opened his mouth to sing the first notes, I realized that something was terribly wrong. He was, as always, technically flawless, but his singing for some reason seemed utterly flat, horribly and completely devoid of life. All around me, people seemed to be in a raptus of attention, listening with profound and unfathomable expressions. They were simulating these, I decided, politely pretending to be moved, when they knew as well as I that Fischer-Dieskau had lost the wonderful warmth and sensibility that used to pervade his voice. I was, of course, totally mistaken, as I came to realize afterwards. The reviewers the next day agreed that Fischer-Dieskau had never been better. It was I who had become lifeless again, cocooned and frozen. So frozen this time that not even Schubert could get to me. Perhaps I was defending myself, walling myself up, against feelings that threatened to be overwhelming. Perhaps, more simply, I was demanding that the music work, where experience had shown me that demanding never succeeds. The power of music, whether joyous or cathartic, must steal on one unawares, come spontaneously as a blessing or a grace, as it did when the music stole from the basement window, or when I was prized open, helplessly, by the broken-hearted eloquence of Zelenka's lamentations. The arts are not drugs, E.M. Forster once wrote. They are not guaranteed to act when taken. Something as mysterious and capricious as the creative impulse has to be released before they can act. John Stuart Mill wanted cheerful music, and it seemed to act as a tonic for him. But Lesser and I, both dealing with the loss of a beloved figure, had very different needs and a very different experience with music. It is not coincidental that the music, which released our grief and allowed emotion to flow again, was a requiem in Lesser's case, and a lamentation in my own. This was music designed for occasions of loss and death, the only sort of music, perhaps, which could speak to our condition. The psychiatrist Alexander Stein has described his experience of 9/11. He lived opposite the World Trade Center, and he saw it hit, watched it crumple, and was caught up in the terrified crowds fleeing down the street, not knowing whether his wife was alive or dead. He and his wife were homeless refugees for the next 3 months. During this time, he writes, my internal world was dominated by a dense and silent pall, as if an entire mode of existence were in an airless vacuum. Music, even the usual internal listening of especially beloved works, had been muted. Paradoxically, life in the auditory sphere was in other respects heightened immeasurably, but calibrated, so it seemed, to a narrow spectrum of sounds. My ears now were attuned more to the roar of fighter jets and the wail of sirens, to my patients, to my wife's breathing at night. It was only after several months, he writes, that music finally returned as a part of life for and in me, and the piece he first heard internally was Bach's Goldberg Variations. On the recent fifth anniversary of September 11th, on my morning bike ride to Battery Park, I heard music as I approached the tip of Manhattan, and then saw and joined a silent crowd, who sat gazing out to sea and listening to a young man playing Bach's Chaconne in D on his violin. When the music ended and the crowd quietly dispersed, it was clear that the music had brought them some profound consolation in a way that no words could ever have done. Music, uniquely among the arts, is both completely abstract and profoundly emotional. It has no power to represent anything particular or external, but it has a unique power to express inner states or feelings. Music can pierce the heart directly. It needs no mediation. One does not have to know anything about Dido and Aeneas to be moved by her lament for him. Anyone who has ever lost someone knows what Dido is expressing, and there is, finally, a deep and mysterious paradox here. For while such music makes one experience pain and grief more intensely, it brings solace and consolation at the same time. Chapter 26. The Case of Harry S. Music and Emotion. Perhaps one should not have favorite patients or patients who break one's heart, but I do. And among them was Harry S. He was the first patient I saw when I came to Beth Abraham Hospital in 1966, and I saw him frequently until his death 30 years later. When I met him, Harry was in his late 30s, a brilliant mechanical engineer. He had studied at MIT, who had had a sudden rupture of a brain aneurysm while cycling up a hill. He had bled extensively into both frontal lobes, and the right was severely damaged. The left less so. He was in a coma for several weeks, and remained irreparably damaged, so it seemed, for months afterwards, months in which his wife, despairing, divorced him. When he finally left the neurosurgical unit and came to Beth Abraham, a hospital for the chronically ill, he had lost his work, his wife, the use of his legs, and a large chunk of his mind and personality. And though he began slowly to regain most of his former intellectual powers, he remained severely impaired emotionally, inert, flat, and indifferent. He would do very little by himself, or for himself, but depended on others for incentive and go. He still subscribed, out of habit, to Scientific American, and would read every issue from cover to cover, as he had before his accident. But while he understood everything he read, none of the articles, he admitted, excited his interest, his wonder, any more. And wonder, he said, had been at the core of his previous life. He would read the daily papers conscientiously, taking in everything, but with an uncaring, indifferent eye. Surrounded by all the emotions, the drama of others in the hospital, people agitated, distressed, in pain, or, more rarely, laughing and joyful, surrounded by their wishes, fears, hopes, aspirations, accidents, tragedies, and occasional jubilations, he himself remained entirely unmoved, seemingly incapable of feeling. He retained the forms of his previous civility, his courtesy, but we had the sense that these were no longer animated by any real feeling. But all this would change, suddenly, when Harry sang. He had a fine tenor voice and loved Irish songs. When he sang, he showed every emotion appropriate to the music, the jovial, the wistful, the tragic, the sublime. And this was astounding, because one saw no hint of this at any other time, and might have thought his emotional capacity was entirely destroyed. It was as if music, its intentionality and feeling, could unlock him or serve as a sort of substitute or prosthesis for his frontal lobes and provide the emotional mechanisms he seemingly lacked. He seemed to be transformed while he sang, but when the song was over, he would relapse within seconds, becoming vacant, indifferent, and inert once again. Or so it seemed to most of us at the hospital. Others had doubts. My colleague, Elchanan Goldberg, a neuropsychologist especially interested in frontal lobe syndromes, was not convinced. Goldberg stressed that such patients may involuntarily echo another's gestures or actions or speech and tend to a sort of involuntary simulation or mimicry. Was Harry's singing then nothing more than an elaborate, automatic sort of mimicry, or did the music somehow allow him to feel emotions to which he normally had no access? Goldberg was uncertain about this. For myself and many others at the hospital, it was hard to believe that these emotions we saw in Harry were simulated, but perhaps that speaks to the power of music for the listener. I had similar uncertainties when I saw Stephen Wiltshire, the autistic savant I have written about in An Anthropologist on Mars. Stephen barely spoke and normally showed very little emotion, even while he was producing his extraordinary drawings. But he could sometimes, so it seemed to me, be transformed by music. Once, when we were in Russia together, we listened to the choir in the Alexander Nevsky Monastery, and Stephen seemed profoundly moved, so I thought, though Margaret Hewson, who had known him well for many years, felt that at a deeper level he was indifferent to the singing. 3 years later, as a teenager, Stephen started singing himself. He sang the Tom Jones song, It's Not Unusual, with great enthusiasm, swinging his hips, dancing, gesticulating. He seemed possessed by the music, and there was none of the stiltedness, the ticking, the aversion of gaze that he normally evinced. I was very startled at this transformation and wrote, Autism disappears, in my notebook. But as soon as the music ended, Stephen looked autistic once again. I still wonder whether the music had given Stephen access to emotions that he normally could not express, or whether what we saw was a sort of impersonation, a brilliant, but in some sense superficial, performance. In 1996, the last time I saw Harry, 30 years after his accident, he had developed hydrocephalus and large cysts in his frontal lobes. He was too ill and fragile for any surgical intervention, but, though so weak, he gathered his last bit of animation and sang for me, Down in the Valley, and Good Night, Irene, with all the delicacy and tenderness of his earlier days. It was his swan song. A week later, he was dead. Chapter 27. Irrepressible. Music and the Temporal Lobes. In 1984, I met Vera B., an elderly woman who had just been admitted to a nursing home because of medical problems, including severe arthritis and breathlessness, that made independent life increasingly difficult for her. I found no neurological problems, but I was struck by the fact that Vera was so high-spirited, talkative, jokey, and a trifle flirtatious. I did not think this was of any neurological import at the time, but just an expression of character. When I saw her again 4 years later, I observed in my notes, she shows impulses to sing old Yiddish songs, and at times a near irrepressible chutzpah. It seems to me now that she is losing her inhibitions. By 1992, this picture of disinhibition had become florid. Sitting outside the clinic, awaiting me, Vera was singing A Bicycle Built for Two in a loud voice, interlarding the lyrics with words of her own invention. In my office, she continued to sing, songs in English, Yiddish, Spanish, Italian, and a polyglot mixture that contained, I suspected, all of these, plus some of her native Latvian. When I phoned Connie Tomeno, our music therapist, she told me that Vera now tended to sing non-stop the entire day. Previously, she had not been terribly musical, Connie said, but she's musical now. It was not easy to have a conversation with Vera. She was impatient with questions and often broke off in mid-answer to sing. I did what mental testing I could, and it was obvious that Vera was basically alert and oriented to her surroundings. She knew that she was an old lady in a hospital. She knew Connie, a young maidla. I forget her name. She was able to write and draw a clock. I was not sure what to make of all this. A peculiar form of dementia, I wrote in my notes. Cerebral disinhibition has proceeded apace. This may be due to an Alzheimer-like process, though surely with Alzheimer's she would be more impaired and confused. But I cannot help wondering about other rarer entities. In particular, I wondered whether she had damage to the frontal lobes of the brain. Damage to the lateral portions of the frontal lobes can lead to inertia and indifference, as with Harry S., but damage to the medial or orbitofrontal areas has a very different effect, depriving one of judgment and restraint and opening the way to a non-stop stream of impulses and associations. People with this type of frontal lobe syndrome may be jokey and impulsive, like Vera, but I had never heard of excessive musicality as one of its symptoms. When Vera died a few months later from a massive heart attack, I tried to get an autopsy, wondering what the brain would show. But autopsies had become rare and difficult to obtain, and I was not successful. I was soon distracted by other matters and did not think about the puzzling case of Vera with her strange and, in a way, creative disinhibition, the wild singing and wordplay that had characterized her final years. It was only in 1998 when I read a paper by Bruce Miller and his colleagues in San Francisco on the emergence of artistic talent in frontotemporal dementia that I suddenly thought of Vera again, and realized that it was probably just such a dementia that she had had, although the emergence with her had been musical rather than visual. But if there could be emergence of visual artistic talents, why not musical ones? Indeed, in 2000, Miller et al. Published a short paper on the emergence of unprecedented musical tastes in some of their patients in the dementia unit at the University of California, San Francisco, and a longer, comprehensive paper with vivid case histories on functional correlates of musical and visual ability in frontotemporal dementia. Miller et al. Described a number of patients who showed heightenings of musical talents, or, in some cases, the startling appearance of musical inclination and talents in previously unmusical people. Such patients had been described before in an anecdotal way, but no one before had seen and followed so many patients or explored their experiences in such depth and detail. I wanted to meet Dr. Miller and, if possible, some of his patients. When we met, Miller first talked in general terms about frontotemporal dementia, how its symptoms and the underlying brain changes that caused them had been described in 1892 by Arnold Pick, even before Alois Alzheimer had described the better-known syndrome that now carries his name. For a time, Pick's disease was considered relatively rare, but it is now becoming clear, Miller pointed out, that it is far from uncommon. Indeed, only about two-thirds of the patients Miller sees in his dementia clinic have Alzheimer's disease. The remaining third have several other conditions, of which frontotemporal dementia is perhaps the most common. Unlike Alzheimer's disease, which usually manifests itself with memory or cognitive losses, frontotemporal dementia often starts with behavioral changes, disinhibitions of one sort or another. This is perhaps a reason why relatives and physicians alike may be slow to recognize its onset, and confusingly, there is no constant clinical picture, but a variety of symptoms, depending on which side of the brain is chiefly affected, and whether the damage is mainly in the frontal or the temporal lobes. The artistic and musical emergences that Miller and others have observed occur only in patients with damage chiefly in the left temporal lobe. Miller had arranged for me to meet one of his patients, Louis F., whose story bore a striking resemblance to Vera B.'s. Even before I saw him, I heard Louis singing in the corridor, as, years before, I had heard Vera singing outside my clinic. When he entered the consulting room with his wife, there was barely a chance for hellos or handshakes, for he instantly burst into speech. "Near my house are seven churches," he started. "I go to three churches on Sunday." Then, presumably moved by the association of church, he burst into, "We wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas." Seeing me sip a cup of coffee, he said, "Go on, when you're old you can't drink coffee." And this then led to a little sing-song, "A cup of coffee, coffee for me, a cup of coffee, coffee for me." I did not know if this was a real song, or just the immediate thought of coffee transformed into a repetitive jingle. A plate of cookies attracted his attention. He took one and ate it voraciously, then another and another. "If you don't take the plate away," his wife said, "he'll eat them all. He'll say he's full, but he'll go on eating. He's put on 20 pounds. "He sometimes puts non-food items into his mouth," she added. "We had some bath salts, shaped like candies, and he grabbed one, but had to spit it out." It was not so easy, however, to take the food away. I moved the plate, kept moving it into more and more inaccessible places, but Louis, without seeming to pay any attention to this, observed all my movements and would infallibly home in on the plate, under the desk, by my feet, in a drawer. His ability to spot things was very acute, his wife told me. He would see coins or glittering objects in the street and pick up tiny crumbs from the floor. Between eating and finding the cookie plate, Louis moved about restlessly and talked or sang non-stop. It was almost impossible to interrupt his speaking to have a conversation or to get him to concentrate on any cognitive task, though he did, at one point, copy a complex geometrical figure and do an arithmetical calculation of a sort that would have been impossible for someone with advanced Alzheimer's. Louis works twice a week at a senior center, leading others in singing sessions. He loves this. His wife feels it may be the only thing that gives him any true pleasure now. He is only in his 60s, and he is not unconscious of what he has lost. "I don't remember that stuff anymore. I don't work anymore. I don't do anything anymore. That's why I help all the seniors," he commented, but he said this with little emotional expression in his face or voice. For the most part, left to his own devices, he will sing upbeat songs with great gusto. I thought that he sang a variety of such songs with sense and sensibility, but Miller cautioned me about assuming too much. For while Louis sang "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean" with great conviction, he could not say, when asked, what an ocean was. Indre Viscontas, a cognitive neuroscientist working with Miller, demonstrated Lewis's indifference to the meaning of words by giving him a nonsensical but phonemically and rhythmically similar version to sing, "My bonnie lies over the ocean, my bonnie lies under the tree, my bonnie lies table and then some, oh bring tact my bonnie to he." Lewis sang this with the same animation, the same emotion and conviction, as he had sung the original. This loss of knowledge, of categories, is characteristic of the semantic dementia which such patients develop. When I started him singing "Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer," he continued it perfectly. But he was not able to say what a reindeer was, or to recognize a drawing of one. So it was not just the verbal or visual representation of reindeers that was impaired, but the idea of a reindeer. He could not say, when I asked him, what Christmas was, but instantly reverted to singing, "We wish you a Merry Christmas." In some sense, then, it seemed to me that Louis existed only in the present, in the act of singing or speaking or performing. And perhaps because of this abyss of non-being which yawned beneath him, he talked, he sang, he moved ceaselessly. Patients like Louis often seem quite bright and intellectually intact, unlike patients with comparably advanced Alzheimer's disease. On formal mental testing, they may indeed achieve normal or superior scores, at least in the earlier stages of their illness. So it is not really a dementia that such patients have, but an amnesia, a loss of factual knowledge, such as the knowledge of what a reindeer is, or Christmas, or an ocean. This forgetting of facts, a semantic amnesia, is in striking contrast to their vivid memories for events and experiences in their own lives, as Andrew Kertesz has commented. It is the reverse, in a way, of what one sees in most patients with amnesia, who retain factual knowledge but lose autobiographical memories. Miller has written about empty speech with regard to patients with frontotemporal dementia, and most of what Lewis said was repetitive, fragmentary, and stereotyped. "Every utterance I've heard before," his wife remarked. And yet there were islands of meaning, moments of lucidity, as when he had spoken of not working, not remembering, not doing anything, which were surely real and heartbreaking, even though they lasted only a second or two before they were forgotten, swept away in the torrent of his distraction. Lewis's wife, who has seen this deterioration descend on her husband over the last year, looked frail and exhausted. "I wake at night," she said, "and see him there, but he is not really there, not really present. When he dies, I will miss him very much, but in some sense, he is already no longer here. He is not the same vibrant person I knew. It is a slow grieving all the way through." She fears, too, that with his impulsive, restless behavior, he will sooner or later have an accident. What Lewis himself feels at this stage, it is difficult to know. Lewis has never had any formal musical education or vocal training, though he had occasionally sung in choruses. But now music and singing dominate his life. He sings with great energy and gusto. It obviously gives him pleasure, and between songs he likes to invent little jingles, like the coffee song. When his mouth is occupied in eating, his fingers will find rhythms, improvise, tap. It is not just the feeling, the emotion of songs, which I am sure he gets despite his dementia, but musical patterns that excite and enchant him, and perhaps hold him together. When they play cards in the evening, Mrs. F. said, "He loves to listen to music, taps his fingers or foot, or sings while he plans his next move. He likes country music or golden oldies." Bruce Miller had perhaps chosen Lewis F. for me to see, because I had spoken of Vera, her disinhibition, her incessant babbling and singing. But there were many other ways, Miller said, that musicality could emerge and come to take over a person's life in the course of a frontotemporal dementia. He had written about several such patients. Miller has described one man who developed frontotemporal dementia in his early 40s. The onset of frontotemporal dementia is often considerably earlier than that of Alzheimer's, and who constantly whistled. He became known as the Whistler at work, mastering a great range of classical and popular pieces, and inventing and singing songs about his bird. Musical tastes, too, may be affected. C. Giraldi et al. Described two patients whose lifelong musical tastes changed with the onset of frontotemporal dementia. One of them, an elderly lawyer with a strong preference for classical music and an antipathy to pop music, which he regarded as mere noise, developed a passion for what he previously hated and would listen to Italian pop music at full volume for many hours each day. B.F. Bove and Y.E. Gaeder described another patient with frontotemporal dementia who developed a consuming passion for polka music. At a much deeper level, a level beyond action, improvisation, and performance, Miller and his colleagues described, in a 2000 paper in the British Journal of Psychiatry, an elderly man with very little musical training or background, who at 68 began composing classical music. Miller emphasized that what occurred, suddenly and spontaneously, to this man, were not musical ideas, but musical patterns, and it was from these, by elaboration and permutation, that he built up his compositions. His mind, Miller wrote, was taken over during composition, and his compositions were of real quality. Several were publicly performed. He continued composing, even when his loss of language and other cognitive skills became severe. Such creative concentration would not be possible for Vera or Lewis, because they had severe frontal lobe damage early in their illnesses, and thus were deprived of the integrative and executive powers needed to reflect on the musical patterns rushing through their heads. Maurice Ravel, the composer, suffered in the last years of his life from a condition that was sometimes called Pick's disease, and would probably now be diagnosed as a form of frontotemporal dementia. He developed a semantic aphasia, an inability to deal with representations and symbols, abstract concepts or categories. His creative mind, though, remained teeming with musical patterns and tunes, patterns and tunes which he could no longer notate or put on paper. Théophile Alajouanin, Ravel's physician, was quick to realize that his illustrious patient had lost musical language, but not his musical inventiveness. One wonders indeed whether Ravel was on the cusp of a dementia when he wrote his Bolero, a work characterized by the relentless repetition of a single musical phrase dozens of times, waxing in loudness and orchestration, but with no development. While such repetition was always part of Ravel's style, in his earlier works it formed a more integral part of much larger musical structures, whereas in Bolero, it could be said, there is the reiterative pattern and nothing else. For Hewlings Jackson 150 years ago, and for Freud, an ardent Jacksonian a few years later, the brain was not a static mosaic of fixed representations or points, but incessantly active and dynamic, with certain potentials being actively suppressed or inhibited, potentials that could be released if this inhibition was lifted. Among such release phenomena, Jackson included epilepsy and chorea, and Freud the violent affects and impulses of the id, if it was uncapped by psychosis. Normally there is a balance in each individual, an equilibrium between excitatory and inhibitory forces. But if there is damage to the more recently evolved anterior temporal lobe of the dominant hemisphere, then this equilibrium may be upset, and there may be a disinhibition or release of the perceptual powers associated with the posterior parietal and temporal areas of the non-dominant hemisphere. This, at least, is the hypothesis which Miller and others entertain, a hypothesis which is now gaining support from brain imaging studies. This hypothesis gains support clinically, too, from cases in which there is an emergence of musical or artistic talent following strokes or other forms of damage to the left hemisphere. This seemed to have been the case with a patient described by Daniel E. Giacomi in 1984. Giacomi's patient had a post-surgical stroke, causing extensive damage in the dominant left hemisphere, especially the anterior frontotemporal areas, which produced not only severe difficulties with expressive language, aphasia, but a strange access of musicality, with incessant whistling and singing, and a passionate interest in music, a profound change in a man whom Giacomi described as musically naive before his stroke. But the strange change did not last. It diminished, Giacomi wrote, in parallel with very good recovery of verbal skills. These findings, he felt, seemed to support the greater role of the non-dominant hemisphere in music, somehow normally dormant and released by dominant hemisphere damage. That musicality might be not only spared, but heightened with damage to the language functions of the left hemisphere, was suggested by Hewlings Jackson as early as 1871, when he wrote of singing in aphasic children. For him, this was an example, one of many, of normally suppressed brain functions being released by damage to others. Such dynamic explanations also seem very plausible in relation to other strange emergences and excesses. The musical hallucinations sometimes released by deafness, the synesthesia sometimes released by blindness, and the savant functions sometimes released by damage to the left hemisphere. There have been many other stories, both in the medical literature and in the popular press, of people who have developed artistic talent following left hemisphere strokes, or whose art has changed in character following such strokes, often becoming less constrained formally and freer emotionally. Such emergences or changes are often rather sudden. One must wonder, too, about the Grandma Moses phenomenon, the unexpected and sometimes sudden appearance of artistic or musical powers in old age. Without speaking of pathology, perhaps indeed one should speak of health here. There may be a variety of inhibitions, psychological, neurological, and social, which may, for one reason or another, relax in one's later years and allow a creativity as surprising to oneself as to others. The musical or artistic powers that may be released in frontotemporal dementia do not come out of the blue. They are, one must presume, potentials or propensities that are already present but inhibited and undeveloped. Once released by damage,